50 years ago, Folkways Records released a 6-album set of recordings that had a profound influence on the folk music revival of the 1950s. The Anthology of American Folk Music was drawn from the collection of Harry Smith, a 29-year-old music lover, poet, and filmmaker living in New York City. Smith had purchased thousands of 78 recordings prior to World War II. Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and the New Lost City Ramblers would later include many of the songs in their performances. Jeff Place is an archivist at the Smithsonian Institution.
Harry was always needing money, so he went into Moses Ash, who ran Folkways Records, just to sell him some 78s. And Mo Ash sort of said, well, you know, Harry, you know all this music. You know, this, why don't you put together some kind of collection of great folk songs for me out of your collection, which was all 78s from the 20s and 30s. So Harry put together these three recordings, and it was, you know, very influential record in the 1950s.
Well, you make Harry sound like a real character, but there is some scholarship here. I mean, he knew his stuff and put it down in his notes.
Oh, he did. There's elements, when you listen to this record, for him it was a sound collage, but there was relationships between each one of the songs. You know, there was juxtapositions, and there were lines in songs that related to other songs that followed.
Yeah.
It was all worked out, and he took it back to, you know, the history of these songs.
Oh, the cuckoo is a pretty bird. She wobbles as she flies. She never hollers cuckoo till the 4th day July.
He also had another quirk that was wonderful here. He would, on each of the ballads, he would write a sort of newspaper headline of what the song was about.
My favorite, I think, is Froggy Went A-Courting, what he does with that one, which is called King Kong Kitchy Kitchy Kimeo.
Frog went a-courting and he did ride King Kong Kitchy Kitchy Kimeo with a sword and a pistol by his side. King Kong Kitchy Kitchy Kimeo.
Zoologic miscegeny achieved in mouse-frog nuptials. Relatives approve.
But they're all like that. I think they're actually kind of, you know, Harry was very serious about those quotes. We all sort of think, ha ha ha, that's really funny, but he was sort of, his attitude, he was seriously trying to, like, sum up the song by using that.
This came out in 52. Did people go running to the record store to get this? Did it take off right away? Or was it kind of a slow burn?
In its earlier years, I think it's more like it's a tortoise as opposed to a hare. It kind of snuck out there, and people, you know, certain in-group people got it. You know, and what had happened was there was people who were musicians and deeply into folk music who, you know, what they had to buy out there in the world of folk music were people like Burl Ives and Richard Dyer Bennett and people who were like more sort of professional and sort of stylized versions of folk songs. Whereas this stuff on the anthology was real raw, you know, was really kind of the real thing from the mountains. And it got out, and certain musicians got hold of this record, and it became a sort of cult following this thing. They just took it to heart. It was the thing for them. They all started incorporating these songs into their repertoire, and if you look at a lot of these songs on this record, I think, you know, The Butcher Boy, Wagoner's Lad, House Carpenter, some of the things on there, they're in the repertoire of all these folk groups during the great popularity of folk music.
The heart is the fortune of all womankind. They're always controlled, they're always confined. Controlled by their parents until they are wise. Then slaves to their husbands the rest of their lives.
One of the things that I find most amazing about this recording and its effect in the early 50s is that these recordings were made from 1926 to 1934. Okay, recordings from 1934 are less than 20 years old at this point, and these people were treating these songs like they were something from another century, go back to the 1980s. It's like somebody going to try to find like the lost Elvis Costello or something. It was almost that kind of effect, and you know how it had come that far. Doc Boggs, who's a Virginia miner, perfect example. He wanted a career as a banjo player, and he actually went to New York and recorded, you know, a handful of times. Had these very influential recordings, you know, probably got paid $100, you know, each time, and then he went back to Virginia. The Depression hit. He spent his life working in the coal mines. And what happened with him, like a lot of these people, is these sort of fans of the anthology, these sort of followers of the anthology, these musicians and folklorists, started going down south to see if they could find these people. So and some of the people involved, like Mike Seeger and Ralph Rensler and others, were involved in things like the Newport Folk Festival, bringing people like John Hurt and Doc Boggs and people back up. And of course, the audience was like, these are people from the anthology. My gosh, they're still alive.
Who rocked the cradle? Who sang the song? Who rocked the cradle when I'm gone? Who rocked the cradle when I'm gone?
So it stimulated the folk revival of the 50s, but also it had a great effect on rock and roll. A lot of these young people, you know, Dylan and others, were originally folkies, but evolved into rockers, and some of that influence.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, the Grateful Dead certainly performed a bunch of songs off this record. Dylan still does stuff off the anthology on his current records.
Well, one of his early numbers was One Kind Favor, or See That My Grave Is Swept Clean, however you want to call it, and that was Blind Lemon Jefferson.
Yep.
Well, it one kind favor I ask of you. Well, it one kind favor I ask of you. Lord, it's one kind favor I ask of you. Please ask my greatest campaign.
Harry Smith was purposely vague about these artists when he put the thing out. His booklet, he had those interesting headlines and stuff, but nowhere does he say anything biographical about these people. He wanted the music to stand on its own. He didn't want anybody to have, you know, prejudice or just, you know, think of these people as in certain categories. He wanted this song to be, the song was really what it was about more than the person to Harry. So when I went back and actually wrote long bios on all these people, what I could find about them, some are pretty obscure, you know, that kind of flipped that a little bit and kind of went against what Harry originally thought. But I think nowadays people sort of in the information world kind of expect that or need that or would want that.
You supplemented Harry Smith's notes, and you noted all the covers over the years. And that's what's really interesting, that they were done as traditional American folk. They were done as rhythm and blues. They were done as rock and roll. I'm looking at Stagger Lee, which I knew from Lloyd Price in the 50s.
Sure.
It had this huge hit, Stagger Lee. Hawaiian. It was done in Hawaiian.
Yeah.
Stagger Lee walked to the bar room and he called a glass of beer. He turned around to Bill Lyons and said, what have you done here? Waiting for the train. Please bring them on.
Harry Smith was around long enough to know what he had done.
He died in 1991, and right before he died, he got a sort of a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award. And when he went up, they led him up on stage, and he got up in front of the sort of, looked like it's totally out of place at this Grammy Awards, and said something to the effect that, I saw my dreams come through. I saw the world change through music.
Jeff Place is the chief archivist with the Ralph Rensler Folklife Archives and Collections at the Smithsonian Institution. The Anthology of American Folk Music was reissued as a 6-CD set by Smithsonian Folkways in 1997. Another volume was released 2 years ago by Revenant Records.